From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you so much for joining us. This is our daily look at Atlanta's varied and exciting cultural scene. And today we are starting the weekend early with music and comedy. You may have heard comedian Tig Notaro on This American Life or seen her gut-wrenching special, Live. We'll talk to her ahead of her appearance at the Tabernacle this weekend. We'll also take a look into the lives of drag performers. And first up, we are thrilled to welcome Indigo Girl Emily Saliers back to the show. Oh, if you have been meaning to do something, or maybe you've just been meaning to get around to it, you might consider Emily Saliers, who has been kicking around the idea of a solo album for the past 30 years or so. But it's not like she's been sitting on her hands. Emily has already built a phenomenal career as one half of the folk pop duo The Indigo Girls, and a lot more. And now, the wait for her first solo record ends today. Emily Saliers, mazel tov, congratulations, and welcome back to City Lights.
Thank you, Lois. I'm really thrilled, and I'm especially thrilled to be with you. I'm going to try not to gush too much. You know we love you. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's so exciting to have you. And first, I was hoping you'd talk about the title. What is the significance of Murmuration Nation?
Well, a murmuration is a flock of starlings, and I've always been drawn to birds. I'm not sure why, particularly blackbirds. And I saw a video footage of a murmuration of starlings, and they do all this shape-shifting, fluid movement in and out of each other. No one really understands why, and even if they think they do, I still don't think we know. But they think maybe it's to ward off prey. But anyway, it's this beautiful soaring togetherness of this flock. I saw it as a metaphor, but what's happening in this country as groups of people form together in their communities and their movements without the hierarchical structures of power or telling them what to do. And so we're flocking together for social change and for understanding in a time in our country where there's so much division. Mm.
Your colleague and almost sister, soul sister, Amy Ray, was on a few weeks ago, and she also had this uplifting message of, we can work together, and we can do this, and we can do this transcending our political beliefs if we just all consider what we face. And that description of Murmuration Nation sums it up beautifully. A lot of people are calling this album surprising, but maybe unexpected is a better word. What do you think distinguishes Murmuration Nation from your profound work with the Indigo Girls?
I think the focus is largely on the rhythmic section. At the center of every track is a rhythmic reality and a groove. And Indigo Girls, we do a little bit. I've always been, I mean, African-American music is the music that really stirs my soul. And so if whether it's gospel or, you know, or whether it's hip-hop, political hip-hop, even non-political hip-hop and R&B singing. So I can't be that, and I don't want to co-opt it, but I just felt that I wanted to bring these songs to life with that rhythmic reality that the African-American history of music has brought to American culture. And so that's what distinguishes it largely, is the focus on the beats, the rhythm, and the groove.
I loved reading your description the reverence you have for R&B artists, music that conveys soul in the greatest of ways. Tell us about what you describe as body music.
Well, I think it's something that you can't process your way through mentally. It's like a direct a shock to your system, the music that just makes you want to sway and move. And we are physical beings, and I feel like a lot of times our mental processing gets in the way. And so music that really strikes at my body and makes me feel and makes me want to sway or move is body music. So, you know, folk music can be quite cerebral. Some of it is just truly in its essence telling the story of the folk. But then a lot of it, you know, at least in my history of songwriting, I've been thinking about things and how to put them down and so on. But really, you know, if I go to an African-American church and hear black gospel music, that is my direct line to the Creator. And it stirs my body and my soul. So it's nice to it's just nice to be near that music. And so I wanted to bring that influence into the album.
Let's hear an example of the influence. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe, well, you choose.
Well,
Serpent Love?
Well, now Serpent Love is kind of a sultry, so it has the groove to it and a bit of that thing. But if you wanted to go in full on the beat, I would go into Spider or OK Corral.
Yeah, let's start with Spider.
Now, you know, I can't leave a song alone. I've got to take the body of a spider and make it be a metaphor for the military-industrial complex. I can't help myself.
You're a poet, Emily. What can we say? But when I was reading about this, there was some reference to heavy metal and Native American a cappella. I got to tell you what I heard, which I mean endearingly, in the very opening. War.
Oh, yeah.
The group. I mean,
oh, the group. Group.
The
not
group.
War, the conflict,
no.
But war, the group. Oh.
Yes. And,
yeah.
Course,
yeah.
Were you born?
Yes. War in the 70s.
Mm.
Yes, ma'am. I was listening. I had my ear glued to the radio in the 70s.
Well, you know, this, like everything else you do, it's just meaningful on so many different layers. And, of course, the beat, the rhythm, that, you know, inextricable link between music, rhythm, the soul. And then you come on with this gorgeous, soothing voice, which is quite a contrast to a lot of the other things that are going on.
Well, it's the only voice I have, so I had to sing with it. And it's actually, Lois, it's like an internal struggle. I have this voice. It's kind of sweet. It's not like a booming voice. And I feel a lot of the beautiful conflict that music can stir within us. I feel inside me and I want to get out. And then I have this vehicle, which is my voice. So it's always been like, oh, I wish I could sing like Amy Ray, or I wish I could sing like Mary J. Blige or Ann Wilson, or, you know, but I can't. And so
you got to be you.
I got to be me. And this is just how I deliver it, with this beautiful production that Lyris Hung, my producer.
Let's talk about her.
Ugh, what can we say about her? She's, Amy and I met her at Michigan Women's Festival, and we became friends, and she came on the road with Indigo Girls. She also had, I mean, she went to Juilliard, Columbia School of Music, so she's got the pedigree, but she's also had her own heavy metal band. She produced their album, and she's played in all kinds of, you know, she can write string arrangements and so on, but she loves all kinds of music. When she started producing these little snippets of ideas I sent to her in her home studio with the beats, I was like, I lost my mind. I was like, this is the one. This is the person who can bring this to life. And now, like, we were just at Eddie's Attic last night. We played two shows, and Lyris was with me, and she just creates this world of music. So even though it's just the two of us, it's, for me, it's very gratifying musically. But the opening in Spider, when it kicks in, is electric violin. It's not electric guitar. So she creates all these crazy sounds with violin, and it's, and she's a great, she's a good egg, as we say.
Now, is she living here now, or is she still in New York?
No, she's a New Yorker, and she lives in New York, and she tours with me and Amy when she can, and then we'll be doing a lot of solo shows together. We're going to take a band out in October and play in Atlanta and across the country, but right now, she's staying at my house and training my unruly dog, because she can do that, too.
Tell me about the unruly dog again.
well, we're talking about Oscar.
Yes.
I got him as a puppy, and he really, really grew, and he's a little bit of a, I don't know how to describe him. He's in his own little world, and we're actually, honestly, we're looking for a better fit for him, a place where he can run and be fully Oscar. And
well, Amy has, what, nine dogs?
I know, she has too many, or she would take them. And Lyra said, because she lives in New York, most of the places are small. She's like, if I had room, I'd take him. I was like, well, let me help you buy a house.
Getting back to the album, by the way, if you're just joining us, this is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitz, is here with you and Emily Saliers. Her solo album, Murmuration Nation, is out today. Let's listen to another track. You and Amy have been performing with full orchestras, mm-hmm. including our own Atlanta Symphony Orchestra,
yes.
over the past few years or so. I was wondering if we could give a listen to Sad One,
mm-hmm.
or Train Inside. Which do you think first?
Let's listen to Sad One.
Okay. We might hear some of that orchestral influence.
Remember when we stole that time alone? We ran like bandits with our bags of gold. We laughed like thieves beneath a liar's moon, and had to pay it all back way too soon. Along my way I've left a trail. Of your situation into the promise of the nearest station.
The strings were just about to come in.
we have time.
This is...
Here we go. music lives in many different places.
It does.
Without ever falling short of a category. It's truly a unique blend that you've created. And Sat One, along with Train Inside, almost sound like they could be the emotional centerpieces of a musical. Have you toyed with the idea of a rock musical? Hey, they have all those cheesy jukebox musicals on Broadway. Why not, you know?
I have toyed with it. I was actually just talking to my friend Lee Nell. She's a playwright, a fabulous local playwright. We were just talking about a musical just the other night, so... I feel like this is a time of great growth for me and excitement and gratitude for all the opportunities that life is offering. And I'd like to just be ready and open to, you know, whatever inspiration comes along. And I can see a musical fitting into that. So I keep saying this to people I talked to, but I saw this card in a card shop that said, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you are?
And?
Young. Like new, like excited, like, you know, and I have a life of great privilege. I never take that for granted. You know, there's just so many people who struggle and they're not in jobs they like, and they've, you know, societally are oppressed and don't have these avenues of opportunity. And, you know, I'd like to always remain grateful for the avenues of opportunity that I have and have had.
Well, that comes through in your work. I'm wondering also about why Fly is the second of the tracks, because let me back up here. It feels like Murmuration Nation is the sort of album that should be listened to from beginning to end, as one would read a book. I mean, I'm not saying this is a memoir, but it feels like it has the arc of a book. And you've called Fly the crux of Murmuration Nation. You've talked about the beautiful starlings and the formations and the metaphor that means for you. So why did you make it second on the track list?
I think it was because it was a musical decision, because we wanted really something to hit hard as the first track, and Spider does that. And then Fly, actually, you know, musically, it's a little more in the pop realm, which is normally associated with the kind of songs that I write. And so we just wanted to start out with a bit of a musical, you know, diversion and then go into Fly. And of course, the name Murmuration Nation and is all tied up in the song Fly. But it is, you know, like Lyris and I were very careful about putting 12 songs together. On the CD, you get 12 songs. That's the album. There are 15 songs that we recorded. So the three ones that are at the end, 13, 14, 15, that you get on the LP or you can download or stream or whatever, those are bonus tracks. Now, not everybody listens to an album from beginning to end anymore, but this is the way that I still approach music. I like to sit down. I like to read the credits and the liner notes. And
oh, and when I think back of, you know, the golden age of LP, how intimate an experience it was to sit down listening to an LP both sides from beginning to end on vinyl and feel like I was getting to know this musician or this group in a way that I wouldn't have known just from hearing a single on the radio, or back when you heard singles on the radio. That's extraordinary, and I think it's very interesting to learn that about the bonus three tracks. Of course, when I just saw the name before I had listened to the track, I was thinking, maybe Superfly is what we were going to hear. But no, and there I am back in my mind.
Back in the 70s.
I can tell when I came of age.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Emily, would you mind talking a little bit again about how you funded this project? Because this is an inspiration for up-and-coming musicians, I think.
It really is. I funded it through a group funding site and company, I guess you could call them, called Pledge Music. And there are lots of other ones, and we considered some other ones like Kickstarter, and there's Indiegogo, and But they do other kinds of projects, but Pledge Music just focuses on musical projects. And so, and if you look at the Pledge Music site, now all kinds of artists are using it. They've already, most of them have already made their record and they use it as a promotional thing. But so what, for me, what it was getting fans involved in the funding and the experience of the record. And so very early on, they could go on and pre-order the record on the site, on the Pledge Music site, for $10, $9.99 or whatever. And then they would get access to all the updates and all the personal videos and messages that I provided on the site along the way. And then there were other things that they could order if they wanted to, like a t-shirt or an LP. Or they could have personal experiences with me. Like, we did a couple brunches at Watershed, my restaurant, and people flew in from across the country. And then we did some Skype sessions where I talked to people. And I did some guitar lessons. And so there was a range of things that if supporters wanted to have them, they could. And then all that money went directly into the making of the record. So without that campaign and without the support of, they're like my patrons, but I have such a deep gratitude for those people, because first I was uncomfortable with the notion of crowdfunding. But as I got into it, and knowing me, I'm like, to the people, like the fans, are you guys okay with this? Because, like, I don't want to ask you, I hate to ask you for money to do. And they were like, we love this. This is good. Don't, it's okay.
We can tell that your mom and dad raised you listening to public radio.
Exactly.
That's, hey, Pledge Music? Keep that in mind.
Hey, how many times have I pledged to WABE? That
is
the truth.
I didn't ask you
that. I know, but it is true. I've got my towel.
But I think what you're saying just speaks volumes about not only the gratitude to the fans, but literally an investment because of their commitment. And they then, come on, you could have stopped with just sending a t-shirt, but lunch or, you know, breakfast at Watershed and a guitar lesson or whatever. You are at a pinnacle in your career, and you do not, I don't mean to say you do not need to do this, but there are many artists nowhere near your stature who don't want to be that connected to their fans. This says a lot.
I loved it. I have to say I was surprised, you know, because I'm a bit of an introvert. After the shows, I'm the first one in my bunk on the bus, and after a show, I just kind of shrink into a shell. But this interaction with the fans, and they're all wonderful. There's no haters out there like in Indigo World. And so it was...
Indigo World, are haters?
No haters. No haters that I've come across.
Oh, good.
You know, like in social media, a lot of times people get negative comments or whatever, but I didn't experience any of that. And honestly, I couldn't have made this particular record without that crowdfunding on a very basic practical level, because we made the record in a beautiful studio in New York, and we went to France to use a woman mixer, Veronica Ferraro, because she was highly recommended, and then we mastered it with one of the best masters in the country. And so all that cost money, and without the help of the fans, couldn't have made this record. And I love this record, and I'm super grateful.
It's easy to understand why. Emily Staliers, it is such a huge honor that you chose to come to us, to WABE, on the day of your first solo release. Thank you so much for joining us again. Mazel tov, and brava for all that you do.
Lois, you are the voice of my family's life, and I love WABE. I do. I love WABE, and I love this local radio that brings the community together. So thank you so much for having me. Really, it's an honor.
And I have to say, as I look at you, and I can just barely see the top part of your face, the nose, eyes, and pretty red hair above the microphone, I see your dear mom.
I see her,
so special to us.
Oh, Mom. Thank you. Hope you're smiling down.
Love you.
And happy birthday to my dad today, 80 years old, Don Saliers.
Don Saliers, an awesome man. Murmuration Nation is out now, and we'll have this interview as well as a link to more information on our website, wabe.org/citylights. And built it on the broken backs of the Chinese. So we-
Support for WABE comes from Jewish Kids Groups, a new kind of Hebrew school designed for Jewish families of all backgrounds, including interfaith, featuring experiential learning in a welcoming environment. More about Sunday and after-school programs at jewishkidsgroups.com. And from the Singleton Law Firm, providing legal assistance in personal injury cases, offering counsel and guidance in navigating the complicated legal landscape in areas of all personal injury and wrongful death cases, atlantainjurycounsel.com.
You're listening to City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. Comedian Tig Notaro performed her iconic "Hello, I Have Cancer" set 5 years ago. If you're not familiar, it's a set of raw gallows humor recounting personal tragedy after tragedy, a bout of intestinal disease, her mom dying, her breakup, and then a breast cancer diagnosis. Fortunately, Tig has not experienced much tragedy in recent years, and she's since made frequent appearances on Conan O'Brien, This American Life, and more. She performs at the Tabernacle this weekend, and I spoke with Tig by phone, starting with our talking about that iconic set in 2012.
Hello. Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you? Hi, how are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you? It's a good time. Diagnosed with cancer. Feels good. Just diagnosed with cancer.
There's a saying that you have referenced, that comedy equals tragedy plus time. You completely ignored that with the set that became your Live album. And since then, have you done any reflecting on what links comedy and tragedy?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I guess a little. It pops into my head here and there, but I also try not to think too much about comedy, as crazy as that may seem, because to me it's just, if something's funny, I hate to dissect it or analyze it too much.
Well, Tig, I was wondering, with all of the adversity you've suffered, do you think that's made you a better comic?
I think that adversity could only make me a better comedian and probably a better person, just with so many different, in so many different ways, because I think that it takes a lot of fear away from me, because I do feel like it puts things into perspective, and, you know, your priorities change, your fear level changes. I feel willing to take certain risks that are more exciting as a comedian, probably as a person as well.
It hasn't been all adversity in the past few years. You've married and you have kids now. Has that informed your comedy, your contentment with your family and your wife?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of people think that to be a comedian is that you have to be suffering and miserable and in a dark place, and I don't buy into that. I feel happier and healthier than I've ever been, and I also feel like I'm the best I've ever been in my career. I just feel like I'm better than ever and happier than ever.
A couple of years ago, my wife and I adopted a precious little kitten named Fluff. That's her given name, and we kept it out of respect for her birth parents. And I realized the other day in the living room that I had never meowed at her. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to totally meow at Fluff. And so I looked at her and I says, meow. And she was like, no way. How is this just now coming up? She was stunned, just with her little kitten stunned face. And she says back to me, she says, meow. Then I says to her, I says, meow. We are going back and forth, having the time of our lives. And then Stephanie leans out of the kitchen and says, I wouldn't do that if I were you. What are you talking about? I wouldn't do that. You don't know what you're saying to her.
Tig, your comedy is sometimes characterized as much by silence you're comfortable with on stage as it is by your jokes. You tend to leave a lot of space for jokes to land. And I'm also thinking about that one bit you did years ago, just pushing a stool around the stage. Do you think your process of working on new material is about building up or paring down now?
You know, I truly like to do whatever is funny, and I like to allow myself to do whatever it is, whether it's a physical bit like pushing a stool or telling a 20-minute long story or, you know, revealing that I had cancer. I just whatever it is that comes to me, I like to make sure that I allow myself to grow and change and do whatever feels right in the moment, because I don't ever want to get caught in the trap of this is what I do now, or this is how I do it, or this is how I've always done it. I just want to always do what feels right and what feels funny.
Well, after those years of Job you endured, it's very heartening to hear that you're happier than you've ever been. Thank you very much for talking with us, and best of luck.
I appreciate it, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Comedian Tig Notaro performs at the Tabernacle this Sunday evening. Up next, catching up with the cast and crew of Atlanta's A Drag. You're listening to City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR.
Support for WABE comes from Cumberland Trust, an independent trust company allowing clients to retain their own investment advisors. Details at cumberlandtrust.com. And from Atlanta Lyric Theater, presenting My Fair Lady, known as the musical by which all other musicals are measured. The quintessential classic runs August 18th through September 3rd. Ticket information at atlantalyric.com.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitz. It's so good to be here with you. Last year, we spoke with the creators of Atlanta's A Drag. It's a reality TV show that follows the lives of five Atlanta queens in and out of drag. After a long journey of ups and downs, the first episode of Atlanta's A Drag will be available to the public on Tuesday. Producer Lauren Cribb is here in studio with us, along with cast members Wild Cherry Sucrette and Bubba Delicious. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And Lauren, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Wild Cherry Sucrette,
yes.
The first episode revolves around the debut of your new weekly drag show. Why did you want to start this show?
I actually retired in 2010 from drag, yes. Around the same time Oprah left the airwaves. So I thought it was a good time to leave. And, you know,
because everything Oprah does is.
Yes,
good.
We revolve around her. But I think Atlanta was just kind of missing a show that combined camp drag and real drag together. And so I kind of came up with this idea of having a show around that.
Can you distinguish for us the difference between camp drag and real drag?
Maybe Bubba can
tell that. Violet Tchotchke.
Oh, wait, elaborate, please.
Camp drag is something that most everyone who started drag sort of did, it seems, in the early years of drag, where it's more comedic and imitation in a fun way, as opposed to Violet, who is amazingly talented at and creative and aerobic and avant-garde out there sort of approach that she does.
I see. Okay.
More so serious and
less tongue-in-cheek and more art form.
If you saw someone in real drag at Target, you may think that could be a real woman. If you saw Bubba or I at Crystal's at 3 a.m, you'd know what she'd be getting.
Right.
Okay, I understand.
Snack after a late show.
The episode shows the tensions, or the differences at least, between the older and younger drag generations. While Cherry Secret and Bubba Delicious, what are some of those differences?
Well, I'd have to say the older ones were here when I think drag is so mainstream now. That's the big difference. You think about the 80s and the 90s, it was probably more so a gay audience. And nowadays, it's, like I said, mainstream. Straight people watch it. You know, straight people come to drag shows all the time. I think it's just a part of our culture now, as opposed to something that was just kind of out there for just the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm.
Every housewife should have a drag queen best friend these days, you know.
That's very true.
Will you be mine?
Sure.
Who will be mine?
I will.
Okay, good. I want to back up, though, with you're saying that originally maybe it was just for the gay community. Where does someone like Dame Edna Everidge come into this scheme? You know, this is the Australian actor who created this marvelous character.
I saw her at the Fox years ago. She was amazing.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. She's more of what I began imitating or doing performances like, comedic, throwing more comedy in than just impersonating someone. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just there's more of the look of more realness these days. I mean, Dame Edna is clearly a character.
And straight.
Right, and straight. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Kind of like Mrs. Doubtfire and Robin Williams, that kind of look.
Yeah.
The more comedic side
but
of it.
But yeah, in a theatrical sense. So I guess, Lauren, I was hoping you would talk about what it's like shooting a reality TV show. We talked about the reasons for bringing drag into the reality TV world the last time you were on. What conversations or angles must you make sure that you capture?
Well, it's very different coming from the film world and coming into reality TV. So that was a shift for me. And especially with Andrew coming from live events, I think that helped me actually, because he's used to dealing more with the real world. And when we got the cast together, some of the challenges were, they hadn't done this before. The only one that had was Violet, so that did help because she was able to kind of rally the troops and kind of give suggestions on when we had to set up as the crew. There's a lot of downtime for the cast to sit around, and you don't want them to lose focus. So I think it was different because you're dealing with it's unscripted. So there, you're not having take after take after take. The cameras are just rolling. So it's challenging because you can't step in and say, cut, cut, cut. You have to let it go. You have to see where the scene goes. So, but it was fun because you got a lot of great moments out of it that you don't get in scripted television.
And yet, it's not scripted. It's called reality. But anyone being filmed or taped is aware that a camera and microphones are on. So are there things that you are saving because, the camera's rolling? Or are you oblivious?
I think when Bubba, Charlie, and I had lunch, I mean, we kind of knew what things we wanted to talk about. And we just, for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours at a time, just ate lunch and talked and talked, and just things came out of our mouths. And we've been, Bubba and I have worked together for years, and so we kind of have that Lucy Ethel repertoire. So, you know, right. I'll make her the butt of the joke and vice versa.
Hey, you didn't bring me any
chocolates. I'll bring you some Sucrettes next time I come.
Of course you will. And let's talk about the names, because they're so funny and outrageous and clever and punny. When did that all start? I mean, Charlie Brown told us this sad story about why he had to be Mr. Charlie right. Brown. And now we've got Wild Cherry Sucrette and Bubba Delicious.
I was originally Bubbalicious, but I got a letter of cease and desist from the chewing gum.
Oh.
Bubbalicious. So I added the D in the middle. That has no meaning.
Right. It just has a good flow. And for me, I started in Athens. In the mid-90s, and there was three of us actually who wanted to do it together, which is very, you never normally see that. I mean, every drag queen is solo, and so we wanted to be a girls group like TLC or En Vogue, and so we were at my apartment, and we were talking about names, and we couldn't come up with anything, and literally, I had a sore throat that week, and there were a can of Sucrettes sitting on the table, and I looked, and I'm like, let's be the Sucrettes, and then I was like, I want to be Wild Cherry. And then someone took honey lemon. Well, there's really not a third flavor, so we named the other one eucalyptus. And so he was only with us for a year, so we kind of just became a duo.
And went California with that. Oh, if you are just joining us, you're listening to City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes here with you, producer Lauren Cribb, Bubba Delicious, and Wild Cherry Sucrette. We'll be back after a short break.
Support for WABE comes from Wellstar Kennestone Hospital, which received Gold Seal Distinction for heart valve, coronary artery bypass surgery, and congestive heart failure. Kennestone is one of only two programs in the country to receive this distinction. Wellstar.org. And from Maggie Kulik & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial. Information can be found at AmeriPriseAdvisors.com by searching Decatur, Georgia. Ameriprise. Be brilliant.
Wild Cherry Sucrette and Bubba Delicious, our guests from Atlanta's a Drag, which is coming out very soon. Could you give us some behind-the-scenes stories about shooting this first episode of Atlanta's a Drag? And Lauren, you're welcome to weigh in here too, the producer.
One of my favorite times was when we were all at the round table just chatting among ourselves and telling stories. And it was sort of like myself and Charlie as the old girls, and then Violet and Puddin' as the new girls, and Cherry somewhere in between there. And us telling some stories and some things that happened, you know, further back that they didn't know who Tammy Faye Baker was. Because they're so young, you know, that they wouldn't have known. But she and I had became personal friends from trying to get her to come here to do a show, which she did with me in 2004.
Okay, well, maybe there are listeners who don't know who Tammy...
There probably are.
Okay, would you explain?
Tammy Faye Baker was married to Jim Baker, who was the founder of PTL in North Carolina. Praise the Lord, a religious ministry that he went to jail later for financial misdealings or whatever. And she divorced him, and she sang and was, you know, the wife.
And cried a lot.
And cried a lot, yes. And she was the first person I ever did a interpretation of, you know, my own version of look-alike. And I had a turkey baster with tubes running up my arm that into my wig, so I squeezed it and tears rolled down my face. Those sorts of things. That's the campy side of drag.
I guess now you're giving us insight into just the kind of exaggerated appeal that a certain type of woman may have that's ripe for parody or for drag.
Right. And she certainly was.
Yeah.
God rest her soul.
Okay, let's get back to the inside stories.
The inside
Beside the behind-the-scenes stories about the first episode.
There's a real good, I don't want to spoil it for us, but Charlie does a great job reading Violet a couple of times.
Yes. There were some fun moments with that.
The youth actually did fit into that a lot. And actually, Charlie and Puddin had never met before, so with the round table that Bubba was speaking about is pretty much
that's a good scene.
Focus.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good scene. A lot of fun. There's some good stuff with that.
Lauren, the first episode of Atlantis Drag is finally going to be available for the public. And I understand the show has been re-edited. What happened with that?
So we screened it the end of last year, and we got some great feedback. We had a great premiere here in Atlanta, which was a beneficial thing as producers. You want to get as much feedback, especially being the first time in reality TV for both Andrew and myself. And took a break for the holidays, regrouped at the beginning of the year, had spoken to a couple networks, and networks go in different directions. You can never predict the entertainment industry. So Andrew and I did some brainstorming and figured out what we wanted to do moving forward. And we know we have a wonderful show with a wonderful group. And as a producer, you want to, it's hard, decisions are hard because you want to make the right one. And sometimes, you know, you don't know. So we decided we wanted to create a little bit better of a story. And we got an editor that has worked with Housewives, with Real Housewives, who has experience, who does this every day. It's second nature. And that helps because our show is very similar to Real Housewives. It's a lifestyle show. So we made that decision. And then between that and then licensing with music and things just take time. Things always take a lot more time than you expect. So between that and, you know, coming up with a release date and getting everybody kind of together on that, you know, we've landed between what shooting this time last year. We're coming on a full year. So we wish we could have brought it out sooner, but I think this has worked out great. If all goes planned, we'll hopefully be able to start shooting right before Pride to continue the first season. So,
and you're going to self-release?
Yes, on the website. Just like Louis C.K., he has a show, and I can't believe the name of the show is not coming to me right now, but it is on his actual website. And he did the self-release and has been very successful with it. And
what exactly are the advantages?
Well, you excuse me, you end up, you don't have to necessarily deal with sales agents or, you know, going through, you know, the distribution process. You're able to the company is able to make the money back itself. You're able to kind of have more of the control, make the decisions under your own umbrella of your company. And it is a little bit more of a risk. And that's why I think we're testing it out. We want to see if it does work out. We hope it does. And we're excited. We're really excited. They've worked so hard. The cast has been great. The crew worked very hard. And, you know, you have to, there's no risk with, you know, hopefully there'll be some reward. So
this is for all three of you. What have each of you learned about the reality TV making process through putting this first episode together? Bubba?
Just be yourself, but you also have to be a bit cautious in what you want to appear as well.
Appear in the show
when it airs, you know, you want to be, you know, we're drag queens, so we're going to be catty and cut up and, you know,
the fun part,
yeah. But you also, you know, Charlie and I had made a pact with each other before we started doing this. Okay, we're going to call you all sorts of names and say things about you and tell stories about you, but we still love you, we still love each other, sort of thing. You know, that, you know, some things you have to, you know, jab people to make it a little exciting as well, and, you know, share some personal stories that maybe you wouldn't share otherwise to keep it interesting.
So you're keeping the not so much the reality, but you very much have the entertainment aspect of it in mind. Wild chair.
I'd say I'd tag along with what Bubba said, just being genuine, but also just when you shoot so many hours and hours, and you just don't know how it's going to be edited together. So a lot of times, I know I'm a genuinely nice person, right, Bubba? But, you know, there's a couple of times.
Say yes, Bubba.
Yes, yes,
there
sir.
Are a couple times, and, you know, that things could be construed that I was being evil or mean to someone, but not on purpose, you know?
Oh,
if I'm
going
to talk about you, I'm just going to blast you on social networking. It doesn't really matter. But.
There's a thin line between bitch and honesty.
And that's not B-I. We spell that differently here. Oh. During, it's not 12 yet. You can't say that word, right?
God, I'm not going into the legalities. Lauren seems dumbstruck. Where do you weigh in on what
patience with reality TV? I mean, and shooting patience. The hours are long in this industry. It's tough at times, and you just have to have a lot of patience.
Will there be more episodes?
We're hoping. We have a plan.
Absolutely.
We're really excited.
We've bought new wigs, so we're ready.
We're all ready.
We have to make use of that. Wild Cherry Sucrette and Bubba Delicious are two notable celebrated drag queens here in Atlanta. They were also talking about Violet Tchotchke and Mr. Charlie Brown. Lauren Cribb is the producer of Atlanta's a Drag. That will be available on their website, atlantasadrag.com, on August 15th. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for having
Thank
us.
You,
Thank
Lewis.
You.
Support for WABE comes from the Mathnasium Learning Centers of Atlanta, committed to the idea that when kids understand math, they enjoy it and do more of it, leading to mastery. There are 26 Mathnasium centers around Atlanta. Mathnasium, we make math make sense. And from LeapFrog, offering managed IT services and solutions designed to help businesses leverage technology to achieve their business goals. More information is available at leapfrogservices.com. LeapFrog, extraordinary IT services.
You've been listening to City Lights, and you can catch an encore broadcast of this show if you missed anything. You can hear it again at 8 o'clock this evening. Tune in Sunday evening at 7 when we'll hear about the Atlanta Arts Mavens of Deer Bear Wolf as they work on expanding their programming to include musician grants and artist emergency funds. Monday morning at 11, we'll talk with Joe Barry Carroll about his journey collecting photos and stories for his new book, Black American Voices. City Lights is a production of WABE at Public Broadcasting Atlanta. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. WABE's MVP of radio is Christine Dempsey, and I'm Lois Reitzes. I'd love it if you followed me on Twitter at LoisReitzes. That's all for this show for today. Thanks for listening to City Lights and to member-supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta's Choice for NPR.